Stardate, October 17th, Mars and Regulus. Stay with us.
Stardate is made possible through funding by the undergraduate students at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. It can be heard every night at midnight and every afternoon at 5:58 on WUSB, Stony Brook.
Stardate, October 17th. In the next week, you can watch a planet and a star play leapfrog in the morning sky. The planet is Mars, and the star is called Regulus. If you look for them, say, tomorrow morning, you'll see Mars located slightly above Regulus. By the middle of next week, the planet will have moved slightly below the star. Again, that's in the morning sky, in the east, before dawn. Mars and Regulus will be the two objects closest together, with the star the brighter of the two. Mars will move from above Regulus to below it, in an illustration of the way that planets move apart from the fixed star background. That's where the word planets comes from. It stems from a Greek word meaning to wander. The stars are moving too, of course, following their individual orbits around the center of the galaxy. But the stars are so far away that on the time scale of human lifetimes, their motions with respect to us or each other aren't easy to notice. The planets, on the other hand, are relatively nearby. They're located within the boundaries of our own solar system, only light minutes or light hours away instead of light years. They move in orbit around the sun, and we can easily see them drift against the background of the starry sky. You can see for yourself. Just look in the east before dawn in the coming week. Mars and the bright star Regulus are the two objects closest together. Mars will start out above Regulus, and in a few days, we'll end up below it. Stardate is written by Deborah Bird and produced for the University of Texas McDonald Observatory. We're in Austin. Our zip is 78712. I'm Joel Block.
The top of 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 Well, we're here. Well, I'm here. I don't know if Eric's around. Eric, are you in there? I don't know what's going on. You're tuned to the Voice of Long Island. I'm Mike Uhas. I don't know where Eric is. Eric, where did he go? I don't know. I guess he's there's something wrong with Eric. I'm not sure. He should be here. He should. Let's see, flip the switch. Yeah, well, he should be here by now. Anyway,
help!
There you are.
Help!
Okay, we hear you.
Anybody hear me?
I hear you.
Call the sock!
Well, turn on the light.
Oh.
That's better.
That's much better.
We hear you much better now.
Oh, I was kind of panicky there. I didn't know where I was.
Yeah.
But, the lights are on now, and okay, everything's fine.
Yeah, so, well, almost close to fine.
Well, as close as we can get on a Friday night.
Yeah. What we just heard from was Volume 1, actually Study Number 3A, from the Complete Studies for Player Piano by Kanla Nankaro.
How about that?
And we'll be getting to more of that later on.
That wasn't a person playing all that stuff, was it?
Well, it was a person who punched out the roles.
But it was more or less the first computer type of music that came out.
Yeah.
Player Piano.
Yeah.
Wow, I think now we've hit everything, Mike.
Just about.
Player piano music is something that you don't hear very often anywhere, even on non-commercial radio.
That's true.
And now we've just done that.
Yes.
If anybody has any favorite player piano tunes that they'd like us to get to, by all means, give us a ring and we'll see if we can find them.
What's the number?
What's our number?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. You can tell me you're going to be asking me questions. 246-7901. I would have gotten it.
Oh, well.
Area code 516.
Right,
WUSB, the Voice of Long Island, and you're what?
Mike Uhas.
And I'm Eric Corley, then. Okay. They switch things around sometimes.
It only follows.
As everything does.
Yeah, sooner or later. So, how was your week?
My week? It was a week, you know.
Yeah.
A week like many others.
The weather's getting kind of
inclement.
Cool. Well, not really
at
inclement.
At times.
It's 11 degrees outdoors.
11 degrees.
What's that, 52?
52 Fahrenheit, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I guess we should mention what's underneath us now.
We have the fall theme from Walter Carlos.
Yes, from the Sonic Seashores.
But he's now Wendy Carlos.
Yes. Yes. That's very true. He changed his gender.
I was very... I can't describe the feeling that I got when you told me that. The feeling you get when anything happens for the first time, and that was interesting. One of my favorite electronic composers.
Changing gender.
Yeah. All in the interest of electronic music, I guess.
Or something like that. I guess this is where the melody starts. I don't know.
Rather appropriate for the past week, because we've been having all sorts of windy weather and...
Yeah,
and
this morning I woke up and
Halloween-type stuff.
So much fog.
Yeah.
Yeah, an awful lot of that stuff. Hello, you still there?
Oh, me, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, driving to work this morning was like coming out of pea soup. Pea soup.
Is that something?
That was something. And what are you doing in there that you're not paying attention, that you're getting all screwed up?
Well, I'm paying total attention. I'm in control.
Oh. Total control, eh? I was wondering how long it was going to take you to screw something up.
I got the car started, didn't I?
Yeah, that's for Gary, right? Gary Pecorino is leaving there.
Mm-hmm. Gary will be back next week at 9 o'clock. There he goes.
So we've got some very special things going on tonight.
We're going to be speaking with the editor of the Dartmouth Review, which is... you might have seen this in the New York Times, a big article about this newspaper. It's sort of a conservative paper that
sort
comes
of,
out.
Yeah.
Rather conservative. I'll be speaking a little bit more about that and speaking, of course, to the editor in Dartmouth, New Hampshire, coming up at about 12:30 or thereabouts. Have the tripods. Have some fabulous messages from the Air Force, which I know you're going to love to hear.
And other branches of the military or something like that.
Yes, other parts of the military that you might not have heard of. All here on The Voice of Long Island.
Right.
Hey, hey. Let's listen to Walter Carlos.
Sure. Thank you.
away, Tom.
Yeah, they called them Sparks.
Ah.
Sparks from an album called Kimono My House. Clever, huh?
Yeah, cute.
That's on Island Records. And the funny thing about Sparks is they've jumped all over the place. I think they've hit every single record label once, at least. Sometimes I think they've come back and hit others.
Really?
A couple
How
other
many
times.
Albums are there?
There were about seven, actually. They just had a new one over the summer.
What label is
and
that?
I kind of forget which label it was, but it would be interesting if I remembered. Talent is an Asset is what we heard, and before that, what was that? Pocket Calculator by Kraftwerk.
Yes, and Wendy, Walter Carlos from the Sonic Seasonings.
And the season we heard was fall, which is what it is now, October 17th.
Yeah.
1981.
Something like that.
Speaking of Einstein and his relatives and things like that, and the relativity and all sorts of...
What, Lou Stevens?
No, Lou Stevens didn't even enter into this.
Oh, that's just as good.
Einstein on this song. Things like that. We've had some rather strange mail recently.
I'll say. Like, listen to this. Hello. My name... Should I give the guy's name?
No.
My name is so-and-so.
Yeah.
I have very important information. I have to talk to the world, or it will die. I have been trying to get in touch for over 10 years. I have written to many professors in my state, newspapers, and Congress a number of times. I have written to all the television stations. I have written to all the kings in the world. I rented a billboard. I bought a full-page color ad in the Chicago Sun-Times. This time I am writing to tell all the radio stations in the United States. Attached are some examples of my work. I feel my avenues are being exhausted. This could very well be the last chance. If you would like to see the world live, please help me get a voice. Thank you. Signed.
So-and-so. What was the date on that letter? Was there one?
There is none.
Well, the date on the letter I have here is September 24th, 1980.
Ooh.
It says, hello, I outproduce Einstein. All he said was E equals MC squared. Matter and energy are the same thing. I am the only one that can describe them as one. The level at which I work, the material, is very concise and unbelievably powerful. The issues, inflation, energy, poverty, etc. Come on, people are never satisfied, FIDE. Life will always be a struggle for survival. The want of development, the competition for resources, the desire of the spotlight, etc. There is one overriding issue, the issue of all issues, life on this planet. It is being threatened very much these days. Do you ever think about peace? What is it? The feeding of the hungry? The lack of all crime? The elimination of pain? No, that just described is not really peace. Peace is just the best situation possible. What is that? I'll tell you one thing. Life is required. I beat Einstein. That's easy. 3D and moving. I also understand all of time. Time is also a necessary ingredient of peace. Time only helps everyone. That is its nature. I'll put it right on the line. I have to talk to the world, or it will die. You have the power to create the demand. I have the understanding to satisfy it. I would like to address the United Nations. Thank you, so-and-so. And I believe you have one more letter.
This one's dated April 29th of 1981. Hello once again. How are you doing? I hope fine. What do you say we take a vote? Capitalism, socialism, dictatorship. Debatable, which is also spelled wrong. What is our common basis? Politics? Our economics? Our social? If not any of these, then what? I hear most of the leaders calling for peace, peace, peace. I have to ask, what is peace? How can we hope to achieve it if we don't have a common basis? Let's take another vote. Life on this planet. I also have to say debatable. I'm sure someone would vote for its death. It is just the least debatable issue I can see. What do you say we use life as our common basis? I would think it would be acceptable to almost everyone forever. I'm sorry to say that life on this planet is being threatened. If we don't stand together for its support, the world will die. I don't have much of anything. I have no money. Of course not. You spend it all on a full-page ad in the Chicago Sun-Times. I don't have any armies or guns. I don't have any land. I have no followers. There is something I do have, though. I have information necessary for the continuation of life on this planet. Without it, the world will die. Again, I ask, what is peace? Not only peace, but peace eternally? If you know, stand up and let the world hear. If you don't, let me. As I did before, again I write to all the heads of state in the world. Thank you. And it's signed again.
Some of that stuff hits you, you know? It's,
yeah, like a brick.
Well, no, really. It's interesting stuff. I believe one of those things had a diagram at the bottom.
Yeah, yours.
No, mine didn't have
a
diagram.
This one here?
That one. Could you describe that?
Well, no.
It's a strange kind of diagram.
It's just a strange diagram. It's got a circle to the left.
Yeah.
And it's got about five lines radially coming out of the circle, kind of going over to the right. And then they sweep down and they all hit little circles.
And five little circles all together.
Yeah.
For each line. Interesting. I wonder what that means. This is the closest thing to the hardware that we've been able to find. It's a little diagram. It says, hello, I beat Einstein. I have to talk to the world or it will die. Please help. Now, there's a big diagram here. And it just says M equals SLGE. Matter equals solid, liquid, gas, and energy.
Ooh.
Matter is that which exists in three-dimensional form and moves.
Ooh.
Matter is made up of electrons, protons, neutrons, and they are moving. Sunlight comes to us from the sun, therefore it is moving. Huh. And then there are all sorts of diagrams here. E equals mc squared, energy equals matter times speed of light squared, 186,000 squared. This amount of energy, big black ball equals a tiny black ball, this amount of matter. But I think all that's known already.
Something like that, yeah.
I'm not a physicist, but interesting. Well, supposedly every station in the country got that letter. He says he wrote to all the radio stations, all the TV stations, and all the kings in the world, so...
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad he didn't leave us out. I'd kind of like to hear these things going on.
Yeah.
I can tell by your face that you do, too.
Yes, I'm falling asleep, actually.
Well, we have a special guest. He's not actually a guest. He's...
We should call him up right now, in fact, because we're 5 minutes overdue.
Oh, are we?
Yeah.
He's in his office of the newspaper in Dartmouth, New Hampshire, the Dartmouth Review. There's an article about this in Tuesday's New York Times, October 13th, I believe. And there's a picture of the editor-in-chief of this newspaper. His name is Dinesh D'Souza. And, in fact, there's a picture of him talking on the telephone. So if you pick up Tuesday's Times, you can see what he looked like when he was talking to us, probably.
Unless he's at home or somewhere.
Yeah, no, this newspaper is causing some controversy because it's supposedly fed by a small group of foundations in Manhattan and a clutch of conservative writers and political figures. And they say that a fresh conservative wind is starting to blow.
I tell you what, how about if I read some of this article and you go try and get him on the line?
Okay, sounds like a good idea to me.
Okay, so he doesn't run out of his office. Thank you. And this is an article written by one Dudley Clendenin in the New York Times. Beginning at Dartmouth College in the North Woods of New England and fed by a small group of foundations in Manhattan and a clutch of conservative writers and political figures, a fresh conservative wind is beginning to blow through the campuses of the Ivy League and beyond. Here at Dartmouth, it has brewed a storm, buffeting a liberal-minded administration and minority groups of women, blacks, American Indians, and homosexual students. Began just over a year ago with the first issue of a new and independent student newspaper called the Dartmouth Review. Now, inspired by the Dartmouth tabloid, plans are being laid for new papers this year at Harvard, Princeton, Brown, and Yale. Now, this article goes on to note that, let's see, there's a whole bunch of people listed on the masthead as members of the advisory board. One Patrick Buchanan, he's the syndicated columnist and former speechwriter for President Nixon, former Senator Norris Cotton and Senator Gordon Humphrey, both New Hampshire Republicans, Jeffrey Hart, the syndicated columnist and Dartmouth professor, Representative Jack Kemp, Republican of upstate New York, of all places, Russell A. Kirk, an author, William A. Rusher,
publisher of the National Review. And each week, the paper offers a special thanks to William F. Buckley, Jr., who has supported the paper with his national column and as a guest at its annual dinner. Now, all sorts of things. Let's see. Mentions William E. Simon. A whole bunch of other people. George Champion, the former champion of the Chase, the former chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank. John Olin, 88-year-old patriarch of the Olin Corporation. A whole bunch of people.
Did you
have him on the line yet?
He's waiting for us. We'll get to him in just a moment. But did you mention one of the things this newspaper did last year that caused... caused quite some controversy.
No, I hadn't gotten up to that yet.
Well,
it's very interesting, though.
It certainly is. I've been getting a lot of people coming up to me and asking me to take a look at this this article. It's kind of interesting that we managed to get rid of this person. At least I can find the exact... Oh, yes, last spring, some of the membership and correspondence files of the Gay Student Alliance disappeared from the College Center, and in late May... some of those names and parts of letters written by lonely students were printed in the review. One student named, according to his friends, became severely depressed and talked repeatedly of suicide. The grandfather of another, who had not found the courage to tell his family of his homosexuality, learned about his grandson when he got his copy of the review in the mail. Now, it says here the review staff had hoped to find a friend in the administration of the college's new president, David T. McLaughlin, the former chairman of the Toro Company, maker of lawnmowers. But because of the homosexuality matter and because the review appropriated the college's copyrighted name and alumni list without permission, Dartmouth officials have now ceased speaking to or giving information to the Dartmouth Review. And Dinesh D'Souza, who we will be talking to in just a moment, says it's quite devastating because this is a small community and much of it depends on the college. It's now the part of the program where we choose from among the billions and billions of people on planet Earth one individual character for an intensive study. We may travel all over the world or simply around the block. But sooner or later, we're going to get you on the Voice of Long Island. Okay, we have Dinesh D'Souza, who is the editor-in-chief of the Dartmouth Review. He's live on our telephone line. Are you there, Dinesh?
Yes, sir.
All right, maybe you'd like to tell us tell us something about the actual starting up of this newspaper, what you had in mind when you first thought of it, or when you first got in on it, and what has actually happened.
I joined the Review about a few weeks after it started. It began when a group of students at the Daily Dartmouth, the campus daily newspaper, were disgruntled with the liberal policies that the newspaper was pursuing. Specifically, the editor of the D, who was conservative, wrote an editorial supporting the trustee candidacy of a conservative trustee candidate, which upset the director of the D, and the editor was fired and removed. And so he took off and decided to start an alternate paper, a different other voice on campus that would not only be for students but also for alumni who had until now simply been getting one perspective on the things that were going on at Dartmouth over the last few years. And so the student whose name is Greg Fossidol and is now a speechwriter with the Reagan administration got together with a group of students, a couple faculty members, and some alumni, and raised a few $1,000, got a little office, and began the Dartmouth Review. I was then at the Daily D, as were a number of other students who were sympathetic to the new movement, and so we switched over. The paper is now a year old. We published our first issue last spring, a year ago, we're moving into our second year now. We've attracted quite a bit of attention because not only are we important in our impact on Dartmouth, but also we see ourselves as part of the larger conservative movement that is sweeping the country.
I see. Now, how often do you come out?
We're a weekly paper, and we have a circulation of about 10,000.
Now, is the goal more or less of your paper to report news or editorialize mostly, or what?
It's a mixture of both. The paper has a news and an editorial section. As far as its news content, we see ourselves as sort of a gadfly newspaper that looks critically at the changes and the activities of the Dartmouth administration. In that sense, however, we are local. Our editorial policy is espouses conservative principles on a national level, and as
I see. What kind of criticism have you been getting, though, from your fellow students and faculty and administration? I understand it's been quite heavy.
Dartmouth is a small community and is not accustomed to the sort of intense metropolitan atmosphere as, say, Harvard, for example. And for years it has sort of trudged along sort of monolithic, singular manner. When the Review first came out, its tone was a little different from the suburban middle-class tone that the Daily D had used. And the administration found the editorial policies of the Review, as well as its practice of going out to alumni, to be offensive, mainly because the alumni, Dartmouth alumni, are the people who finance the college and keep it going. And now that the Review is providing an alternate view, a second viewpoint, if you will, to the alumni, this was upsetting to the administration. What we have here is a fundamental dichotomy between what the administration of the college wants to achieve and what the alumni want the administration to do. And the only way the administration can go about doing what it wants without suffering harm is by keeping the alumni from knowing what is going on. The Review, by reporting to alumni about the events going on at Dartmouth, had thus, in a sense, struck at the Achilles heel of the college, and this was the single greatest blow to the administration. And that's primarily the reason why the administration has made numerous efforts to stop us from publishing. Now, the argument that the administration raises is the fact that we use the name Dartmouth in the name of our publication, the Dartmouth Review. And the college claims it has proprietary rights to the name Dartmouth and that we are not allowed to use the name. We feel, however, that for three reasons we should be able to use the name Dartmouth. One, a newspaper pretty much has First Amendment rights to name itself what it wants. Two, we're a newspaper that is put out by Dartmouth students. We write about Dartmouth College and we circulate to the Dartmouth community and to Dartmouth alumni. And three, there are approximately 25 commercial establishments in Hanover, a town where Dartmouth is, which use the name Dartmouth, Dartmouth Co-op, Dartmouth Printing, none of which are owned by the college, and all of which use the name Dartmouth for profit-making purposes. We think the college is sort of selectively applying the name argument when what they really oppose is the review's contact with alumni. So these have been the criticisms. The college has followed sort of an oscillating criticism theory. There never has been one single objection that they have voiced. It's sort of switched around from the paper's irresponsible to the fact that the paper's using the name Dartmouth illegitimately to the fact that the paper's uncivilized in tone.
Now, do you have your offices directly on campus there?
Our offices are in the center of Main Street in Hanover. They're not very plush, not as big as the Daily D, because we're you know, a young and small organization yet, but we're growing. We have a group of about 50 interested freshmen, and you know, we think we'll be bigger soon.
Now, according to the New York Times, the paper is funded by various corporations and things like. Could you explain that a little bit?
The newspaper has a budget of approximately $100,000 a year. Which is split into three, funded by advertising revenues, by donations and subscriptions from approximately 1,500 alumni all over the country, and from grants from conservative and journalistic foundations.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, that's how we support ourselves.
I see. Now, how are you linked to the entire new right? Is it a very strong link, or is it just a philosophical link?
Well, I wouldn't classify the paper necessarily as part of the new right, although it certainly does agree with many of the things that the new right wants. The paper was initially patterned after National Review, and it's sort of sprightly, irreverent tone is borrowed from there. That's why we picked the name the Dartmouth Review. We didn't, you know, anticipate the furor over using the name.
And each week the paper says a special thanks to William F. Buckley Jr., I believe.
Not because of any direct daily contribution that Mr. Buckley makes, but rather because of the fact that most editors of the newspaper see William F. Buckley is sort of an intellectual icon or sort of a guru we draw inspiration from. Mr. Buckley does, of course, like the paper. Jeffrey Hart, who's a professor of English at the college, is also a senior editor of National Review, and we have had Mr. Buckley up here for cocktail parties and to speak to undergraduates. We also use his columns occasionally in the paper. And he has written about Dartmouth.
I see. So William Buckley does sometimes contribute to the Dartmouth Review.
Oh, certainly. He lets us use a syndicated column.
I see. Has anything been written about the Dartmouth Review in the National Review?
Yeah. Greg Fossil, who founded the paper, and I wrote a six-page article in National Review a few weeks ago called Dartmouth's Restoration, in which we explained the genesis of the paper and then how it's come along despite the torrent of pressures that we've been put under by the administration. So the National Review has given us coverage.
I see. Now, you've told us about what the objections of the administration have been towards you, but what objections do you have towards the administration, specific ones?
Well, specifically, the review objects to the sudden and drastic changes that have been imposed upon Dartmouth unreasonably, in our opinion, over the last 10 years. This trend really started in the late 40s and early 50s when Dartmouth had a president by the name of John Dickey, who was really the first government bureaucrat to be college president here. The changes involved co-education, which was probably inevitable anyway, but was instituted in an undemocratic and strange form at Dartmouth in 1972.
In what way?
Excuse me?
In what way undemocratic?
Undemocratic in that the alumni and the student body and faculty were not adequately consulted and the issue was not adequately debated before Dartmouth decided to go co-ed. It seemed like the president, the new president of the college, a gentleman by the name of John Kennedy, simply felt that the nation was moving, change was inevitable, let's go co-ed.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Also, in the same year, what Dartmouth did was abolish its traditional Indian symbol, which it has had for over 150 years now, over 200 years, as a matter of fact. Not only did it abolish the Indian symbol as the official college symbol by expunging it from football uniforms and so forth, but it also prohibited students from continuing to use the symbol on their jackets and their dorms and so forth. The symbol, although unimportant in itself, was indicative of a larger trend here, which we found deeply disturbing and contrary to the freedom and the exchange of ideas, the robust debate that should be characteristic of an Ivy League institution. There are also minor things that we oppose. The Dartmouth Plan, which is the quarterly system of calendar education by which students are expected to learn courses in 3 months. It's very difficult to study 12 Shakespeare plays in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hanover, you have to register a party if you, you know, regardless of whether you're throwing it on college property or not. So these little things, we think, add up into a sort of disturbing whole.
All right, now you said that perhaps Dartmouth shouldn't have gone co-ed quite so fast, that maybe if it took a little longer, it would have worked better. That is what you're saying, right?
I don't think it's a question of time, but rather one of understanding and studying the issue more. I think that it is very possible that both the alumni and the students would be very gung-ho for going co-ed, in which case Dartmouth should have gone co-ed in 72 or even before. But I'm just objecting to the manner in which co-education and other changes were instituted.
All right, does this carry over into any broader government decisions as far as national race relations or sex equality goes?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay, does your attitude towards the co-education of Dartmouth carry over into the country itself? In other words...
Yes, although I think it has nothing to do with co-education per se, the review also espouses conservative principles in that it is opposed to affirmative action programs for minorities. I know I myself happen to be a minority. I'm originally from Bombay, and I've lived in this country for 3 years. And this is not out of any inherent dislike for minority students or for foreigners, but simply stemming from a belief that affirmative action does little to enhance either the welfare of minorities or of Dartmouth, the educational institution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I see. All right. Now, there was one thing in particular, though, that this article does bring out, and that was something that occurred last year with publishing some names and letters that I understand were caused quite a bit of objection. Do you know which I'm talking about?
Oh, certainly. The the review was furnished information in the spring about the activities of the Gay Students Association at the college. The review does not object per se to the fact that people are gay, but what it does object to is the fact that the college funds organization that is based solely on sexual affiliation. Our belief is that the college should not fund this group, and we think that the alumni tend to agree with this belief. Now, we received information about activities of the Gay Students Association and wrote it up in a rather straightforward, factual tone with no malice at all. The intent was simply to inform alumni of the kind of activity that they were paying for. However, the article was taken in a totally negative spirit, and I'm not sure if that was done out of ignorance or out of malice. I suspect
but
malice.
Surely you can see how publishing the names of these people could cause quite a painful situation for many of them.
Well, the rumors are that the review published lists of names and lists of lonely letters from homosexual people. That is absolutely untrue. The article was a relatively long article, and it contained in the middle of it the names of four people who were officers of the Gay Students Association. Now, the college has a central committee which dispenses funds to different organizations, and organizations are required to file the names of their officers with the central organization. I would expect that if a person is gay and wished to align himself with the Gay Students Association, that he would not voluntarily become an officer and sign up with the central committee had he wanted his name to be absolutely confidential. When we printed the names of the officers, which are the president, vice president, treasurer, you know, we had absolutely no knowledge that it turned out that one of these people did not want the fact to be known that he was gay. I did know that two of the other people whose names we mentioned had been quoted in the local student newspapers in the past, and, you know, I knew that they were out of the closet, so to speak. I think that if one wants to protect one's sexual identity, one should not, join an organization that comes together solely on that basis, and B, become an officer of that organization and edit the newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So then you
again,
basically...
When the second part of that, which has to do with our printing letters from either gay students to the association or one gay to another, we simply did that. We didn't print letters, but simply sentences to convey the sense of loneliness and frustration that people feel. We did not include names with the letters of the New York Times article erroneously, and I think viciously suggested.
So basically, then, the only direct personal references was to the officers of the organization.
We simply said, for the sentence read like this, the officers of the Gay Students Association are 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we just moved on. It was sort of an innocuous thing that we grew to regret because of the storm it generated. It was something that was totally unintentional.
Was any sort of a retraction or an apology printed for these people?
No, none. That was not printed, and the reason for that was this: when the article came out, the Gay Students Association, rather than coming and talking to us or filing a complaint, went to the dean's office and said that the article was totally made up, that none of it was true, and that the review was sort of out to get them, so to speak. One student went to the dean and complained that we had started rumors that he was contemplating suicide because we had used his name. Again, something that was not true, and so the dean called us in and asked us why we used the student's name, because A, he was not a member of the Gay Students Association, and B, why were we spreading rumors that he was committing suicide, to which we replied, you know, one, yes, he is a member of the Gay Students Association, and we have proof of this, and B, we would never start a rumor that he was committing suicide, because that would be disastrous to the image of the paper, and we had no knowledge of his ever trying to do such a thing. Well, the fact that the deans, the alumni magazine, and the local student newspaper all took the attitude that the story was made up, a couple of weeks later, we simply printed a part of the GSA, Gay Students Association, newsletter listing those same five people as evidence that our story was accurate, Now we ran a little prefix to that, simply saying that we're sorry that we have to do this, but you know, the credibility of the paper is at stake, and the Gay Students Association got a bunch of students together and had a rally to protest the story and so forth. So the thing sort of eroded and became bitter, something that we've always regretted. But no, we did not print up an apology.
I see. Now, tell me just one other thing. Do you get much input into the paper as far as letters and things from other organizations? And if so, do you print them often?
Yeah, we receive 5 to 6 letters per week from organizations and professors. And we print every letter we get, so long as it conforms to basic standards, so long as it's not obscene or anything like that. So we do run a whole page of letters when we have them.
Yeah, could you give us an idea of some of your stories this week, what your headlines were?
Sure. a couple of weeks ago, we did a story in which several employees of Fair Dining Hall, which is the college dining system, alleged that top supervisors and heads were stealing food from the dining hall. And so we ran an article alleging that approximately $100,000 worth of food per year was either wasted or stolen from Fair Dining Hall. The administration has never responded to that charge. It's part of a new policy that they've instituted of non-cooperation with the review, by which they don't make available to us even basic information, something that we consider to be in violation of the First Amendment. But now, when the Thayer story came out and the administration did not respond, what happened 2 weeks later, and which is our lead story this week, is that the head clerk at Thayer, the lady who is in charge of receiving all cash and charge intakes at the dining hall, has resigned. And the reason she resigned is because the top supervisors at the dining hall suspected her of having leaked the information to the review. Now, note how the college is not trying to clean up its own act as far as alleged theft is concerned, but rather trying to prevent the flow of information from employees to a newspaper. But the lady basically quit her job because she was being harassed for leaking information to us, which she did not do. As a matter of fact, she was not one of our sources. But she also has come out in public and confirmed what we have said. In other words, she has said that very often, you know, large quantities of food are taken out and either vouchers are not made up for them or vouchers are made up for them and the money is not paid to her. So that's an example of the news stories we've done. We've conducted interviews in the last couple months with people like William Buckley, William Simon, Ralph Nader, Jack Anderson. We interview Milton Friedman next Monday. Our editorials, try to balance national coverage with local coverage. We run columns by Hart, Buckley, on national issues, and the MX and the AWACS and so forth. And then we run Dartmouth students commenting either on national issues or on party registration and things that are going on at the college.
A couple of final questions. What is your opinion of the moral majority and of the Reagan administration?
I think the Reagan administration is the crowning glory of the universe, and seriously, is performing an excellent job. The moral majority, it's a little more complex. I certainly do not think that an America that was ruled by the moral majority would necessarily be a good one, but I think that the moral majority, the general direction that the moral majority wants to go in is one I totally agree with. I also think that the moral majority is a very important part of the Reagan coalition, which is comprised dually of the fiscal conservatives and the social conservatives. And Reagan can afford to lose neither of those coalitions, neither of those groups. when, for example, Barry Goldwater comes out and then criticizes the moral majority for their extreme views and their bad behavior, I think he fails to appreciate this delicate coalition. And so, insofar as the moral majority wants to go in the direction that Reagan wants to go, I think I agree with them. But I think they would go a step further, and that's when my support would lag.
Could you be more specific as to what that step would entail?
Excuse me?
What would that extra step entail that the moral majority would take?
Well, the moral majority doesn't like James Joyce, and I like Joyce. I do think that it's important to realize that the moral majority is not, in fact, running the show. They are not in power, so to speak, and are simply lobbying as a democratic lobby group, which they certainly have every right to do.
Mm-hmm. How strong would you rate them, though, as one of those lobbying groups? Would you say they're the strongest one around today?
No, I would say that they might be by themselves the strongest one around today, but over in the 60s, for example, we had a whole hive of liberal groups that became extremely powerful, and I think the moral majority is about fair game for this whole host on the other side, Planned Parenthood, the National Organization of Women, and NAACP, and so on.
I see. One final question, then we have to break away. What is your opinion of James Watt?
I don't know very much about his specific policies, and from what I hear, he is somewhat extreme in his application of the principle that one should not allow restrictive regulations to get in the way of a free enterprise search for energy. There's a fine line here in which one has to balance a trade-off between how much one needs the energy, what utility the energy has for you, and what potential damage one is going to cause to the environment. I think one has to evaluate each case ad hoc and decide whether the advantages of opening a formerly taboo area to exploration outweighs the disadvantage of harming the environment and killing the snail darter. but I certainly think that the old environmentalist position, namely that one cannot put a price on the environment, that one cannot put a price on clean air or on water, is incorrect.
I said, you feel people like James Watt are good for the administration and or the country?
Well, I think that that James Watt thinks in the general direction that I do, but again, it's a question of degree. I don't know if James Watt is willing to go all the way and remove all controls whatsoever. I certainly think that some controls are not only advisable, but extremely necessary. To the degree that James Watt is willing to recognize that controls are necessary and reasonably evaluate each situation, I would think that he would be good. I've never met Mr. Watt, and I don't know whether he does these things.
Okay. All right. Dinesh D'Souza, editor of the Dartmouth Review. I want to thank you for talking to us. Mike, you have one more thing?
Yes, I have one more thing. If you could send us a sample copy of your paper, we'd really get a blast out of it.
I'd be happy to do that if you would be willing to send me a transcript of what went on today.
Well, I guess we could work out a deal.
Yeah,
great.
We could send you a tape. We'll get in touch with you then.
Fine.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, Mike, we have a bunch of other things coming up.
Yeah,
and
like the tripod.
The tripods are some of them.
There's a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, I'm the voice of Long Island. That's it for Dartmouth, New Hampshire. We'd appreciate your input on this. We'll be talking to people all over the country in island, town, block, getting their opinions on just what's going on in the
studio. Yes.
Room
246-7901
is our telephone number, area code 516. And that was a rather interesting discussion.
Oh, we should mention that you're listening to WUSB
in Stony Brook. It's 11 minutes after 1 and 11 degrees outside.
See, I knew all those ones would work out for you one time or another.
Well, it was 11-11 the last time.
Yeah,
but we'll let it go. Thank you. Voice of Long Island theme on USB.
As played by Andy Lish.
Andy Lish, who does a contemporary spiritual music program every Sunday morning, Saturday night, what have you, from 3 a.m. until 7 in the morning.
Right.
Mike, you have an interesting article there, I happen to notice, in this week's Newsweek.
Sure.
Something that's not usually talked about.
Reggae music.
Yeah, not only reggae music, but
dub.
Dub style. Okay, let's hear something about that.
Well, picture a band of hirsute Jamaicans with knotty locks and sullen stares playing reggae variations on a Nino Rota score for a non-existent film, say a Fellini remake of Lawrence of Arabia. The leader states an oriental theme on his melodica, a toy-sized wind instrument that looks and sounds like a dwarf accordion. The lilt of the rhythm evokes the lope of camels. Mm-hmm. A roller rink organ recalls Telstar, the trashy rock hit from 1962. Now imagine a recording of this improbable ensemble turned inside out with electronic gimmicks so that each instrument seems to drift in a twilight zone by itself. We hear a drum row, a fanfare for melodica and organ, a trickle of piano, and then, hold everything, the beat vanishes, instruments waft off into space, the beat reappears, the melody disappears, a guitar telephones a chord from across town, a melodica glides by on a gust of echo.
Wow.
Weirdness. Should I read this?
Whoa, be the interesting part.
Yeah, weirdness. So begins Selassie I Dub, a recent recording by Augustus Pablo, the world's greatest master of dub. The hypnotic weirdness of such music has helped make dub the most popular form of reggae today, and also a prime influence on such new wave rock bands as The Clash, The Gang of Four, and Public Image Limited.
Limited.
Yeah. An eerie sort of high-tech folk art, dub was pioneered in Jamaica in the early 70s by Coxon Dodd, Lee Perry, and King Tubby, producers and engineers who fooled around with a finished recording, dropping out the voices and adding an echo to each instrument. Dancers loved the ghostly new sound, and so did island disc jockeys. I believe
island
they mean
Jamaica.
Yes, right.
The island of Long Island, too.
Yes, who toasted, and there's three of us together now, me, you, and Gary Pecorino.
Gary Pecorino came back.
Yes, who toasted over the records in madcap raps. A flood of dub versions followed, most of them using pilfered band tracks. Selassie I Dub, for example, is a remixed version of an early instrumental by Augustus Pablo entitled Selassie I Chant. Pablo cuts the most striking figure of all the current dub artists. Raised in Kingston as Horace Swabby, he taught himself to play piano, then discovered the melodica accidentally. By the time he began working in Kingston studios in the late 1960s, he was scarcely 16 years old, the unusual instrument had become his special voice, adding a plaintive note to such reggae hits as The Sun Is Shining by the Wailers. In 1971, a producer decided that Augustus Pablo somehow had caught the fractured mobility of his homespun art, and the name stuck. I wonder who that producer was. Maybe it was Lister.
Might have been Lister. Maybe even Phelps Smart.
They've been around. Pablo's playing is steeped in American jazz and soul. He reportedly admires vibraharvest Milt Jackson, formerly the Modern Jazz Quartet, and there's certainly an affinity between Jackson's sleepy vibrato and the hang glide sonics of an echoed melodica.
Could you describe what a melodica looks like?
Well, it just looks like a piano keyboard that you stick in your mouth. That's exactly what it looks like.
Interesting, but there must be some sort of a wind part of it that that you play.
Yeah, well, you have to stick that part in your mouth.
Your teeth or something.
I don't know. That's exactly what it looks like. It shows this fellow standing in the middle of a shanty town here.
And he has a sullen stare on his face. For
yes,
sure.
Yes, that's sullen.
Yes, I love sullen stares. I think they're really fun to look at.
You usually have one on your face, too.
Yeah, that's why, you know. I like to have something good to look at in the mirror.
Yes, but the prevailing atmosphere of his playing is not so much musical as religious. Uh-huh. Here comes the important part.
Rasta.
Yeah. Like most reggae stars, Pablo preaches the Rastafarian faith and reveres Ethiopia's late emperor Haile Selassie as the divine prophet of a coming African redemption. Now, since Rastafarians consider themselves enslaved in a foreign land, they sometimes sing of being lost in a Babylon, but Pablo's music sounds lost. Gypsy melodies play hide-and-seek among peekaboo rhythms, vanishing in ribbons of echo. Only the snaking pulses of the bass offer the dancer any solace, and it, too, can sometimes evaporate altogether. In a play of scrambled silences, beat and song must be taken on faith. Memory and bodily momentum fill the blanks. One reason this exiled music can seem so sensuous and haunting.
Haunting.
Yes. Now, Pablo's last album of new material, Rockers Meets King Tubby's in a Firehouse, which is on, how do you pronounce this?
Shinachi, I would say.
Or Shinachi Records.
Maybe.
Something like that. Offers a fine sample of his offbeat art, including Selassie I Dub. His new American label, Message, which plans to release most of his previous albums, is reissuing this week East of the River Nile, perhaps Pablo's most haunting record. Meanwhile, the maestro of the spooky melodica is at work on his next dub breakthrough, Earth's Rightful Ruler.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting that this
is just about done here now.
Oh, okay.
Like the music he makes, Pablo remains a spectral presence, most tangible in the fleeting strains of his strange nomadic anthems for a tribe of displaced souls. Now, this article was written by a fellow named Jim Miller. It appears in the October 19th edition of Newsweek.
Well, interesting that they're reviewing this song that... you okay?
Excuse me.
That actually
That was
out.
The October edition, 19th edition of Newsweek.
I hope you didn't hear it.
Yeah.
The album that song is on came out in January.
Well, that's when we got it.
That's when we got it. I believe it says 1980 on it, so it was actually made in 1980. Why... It takes so long for them to review this song. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, that's just one of the obstacles reggae has to conquer.
Of course, they also mentioned that something's coming out this week, so perhaps they time both events, the album and this thing. I don't know. It's kind of weird, but...
Yeah.
We still have to have that album, and we have that song that they described as haunting, and well, we'll get to hear what a melodica sounds like. Does that sound good to you, Mike?
Sounds great to me.
Selassie I Dub from Augustus Pablo.
Interesting how these things just kind of seem to fade off into the distance, isn't it?
Yes, play a piano.
There you are.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I was just wanting to make sure you were there.
I'm here.
So I heard you in the other ear, actually. Yeah, this is volume one, again, of the Complete Studies for Player Piano by Conlon Nancaro.
How complete do those studies get, anyway?
Well, we just heard from, we heard study number 3E.
Oh, that sounds pretty complete.
Yeah, before we heard study 3A. And if we were to continue on with this record, that's the beginning of
study. That sounds like you're playing a piano right in there, which I know is impossible.
Well, I could be in the other studio playing it. This is study number 20. And on the other side is study number 41, A, B, and C.
Mm-hmm. What happened to all the ones in between?
I don't know.
Well, you can learn a lot about player pianos, I guess.
That's for sure.
Is the piano the only thing that they have made, the only instrument that they can make to play itself?
Well, I don't think they've made player tubas yet.
No, that's true. Or player guitars.
Right.
Or player synthesizers. No, they have player synthesizers in a sense. Anything keyboards, I guess they can program to do whatever they want to do.
True, yeah.
But they don't have player drums.
That's true. They don't have anything player dubbed.
No.
So what do you have for us in that other studio?
Well, we have something we've been talking about a little while ago. We actually got this record a couple of months ago, and it was rescued from the garbage can a couple of times.
Oh?
It's called Get the Spirit.
And
it's an Air Force Public Service record.
Oh, yes.
A lot of little announcements. It's produced by the Creative Division of the U.S. Air Force Recruiting Service. So I'd like to drop by there and see just what the Creative Division does. Must be interesting.
Yeah.
This record boasts a new cover and a new series of 12 public service radio spots. It says, starting with this series, each spot's disc will have a different cover.
Mm-hmm.
While each disc is...
It's too bad it's not TV.
No, while each disc is cleared for a year's use, they plan to release a new series every other month.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of good stuff coming your way.
Yeah.
They thank everybody for their generous support over the past year. It has been exceptional, they say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we have here are a couple of messages from the Air Force Public Service announcement people, Creative Division, all that. I have a couple of... So I don't really know. Why don't we just play the announcements and...
And then the other one?
We have a total, I believe, of about 4 announcements. All right, now we'll play all 4.
Oh.
And Well, perhaps folks could call us up and tell us which they think is the authentic military here, because I listened to it. It was kind of hard. It's kind of hard to decide.
Well, let's get into it.
What's the phone number so people can call up and give us their...
Oh, they know it by now.
I hope so.
Okay.
I don't. What is it?
246-7901. Right.
Oh, good. Okay, this is an announcement. I'm not sure if this is the authentic one or if the one we hear after this will be the authentic one. You tell us.
This is the sound of security. Air Force style. The Air Force security policeman who's there, able to take charge in a crisis, responding to the call. From law enforcement and crime prevention to freeing a treed kitten or protecting a visiting dignitary, the Air Force security policeman is someone you can depend on to be in control. To do the job or handle an emergency. And you can be one if you qualify. But that's only one sound of the Air Force. From pilots and navigators to careers and computers of the health field, you'll find the career that sounds right for you. We offer experience with good pay in the Air Force, opportunities for advancement, and a sense of security in your future. So talk to your local Air Force recruiter and sound out your future in the United States Air Force. It's a great way of life.
This is the sound of security, military style. The military security policeman who's there, able to take charge in a crisis, responding to the call. From law enforcement and crime prevention to cleaning up the officers' club to learning how to make silly commercials, the military security policeman is someone you can depend on to be in control.
Hey, watch out! Watch out for that thing, it's falling! Oh my God! Watch out!
To do the job of handling an emergency, and you can be one if you qualify. But that's only one sound of the military. Between the tanks, jeeps, bombers, and missiles, you'll find the career that sounds right for you. And you won't regret your decision, or you'll be very sorry.
Service announcement on behalf of the military-industrial complex and this station.
The station, of course, which is WUSB, and we're at 90.1 on your FM, and we're listening to some things we've got in, and we don't know where they've come from or where they're going to go to, and I don't know, I think we've got something else right about now.
High technology. Amazing, isn't it? Machines can do almost anything. Well, almost anything. But it still takes people, good people, to make them work properly, no matter how advanced the technology. And when you've got the people and the equipment, the sky's the limit. The U.S. Air Force has the machines. Now it's looking for the people who speak their language. If you are an electrical, aeronautical, astronautical, or civil engineer, the Air Force can be a great way of life for you. We speak your language by giving you immediate management experience, rewarding career opportunities, and 30 days of vacation with pay each year. Talk to your local Air Force recruiter and find out more about the challenge of high technology in the United States Air Force.
High technology. Amazing, isn't it? Machines can do almost anything. But it still takes people, and good people, to make the confounded things work properly.
Ah!
Well, I tried just about everything there is to try. Except that spanner right over there.
And when you've got the people and the equipment, the sky is the limit. The U.S. military has the machines. Now it's looking for the people who speak their language.
Parlez-vous français?
No comprendo.
Ni jamás, ni jamás.
If you think you can help us, please contact your local recruitment officer. Hurry!
A public service announcement on behalf of the military industrial complex and this station.
From a band called Kinesis, from an album they have out called New Life. And you're hearing that here on USB, the voice of Long Island. This is a digital master, an audiophile pressing. And the song we heard was called Root Beer. And let's see, now what else is going on? About maybe 15 minutes, we'll have a look at the news, including a story about Fisher's Island, of all places.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Fisher's Island made the news?
Yes, it did.
You know, we're going to have to go there, and soon.
One of these days.
I'd kind of like to go there towards the end of fall and see all the leaves and their trees falling on the ground.
Yes.
If they have any trees, I don't even know.
Yeah. Right now it's 11 degrees in Stony Brook on the, as Rich Koch would say, on the Gold Coast of Long Island. Is that what he would say?
I thought you said Ivory Coast, but maybe you're right, it was gold.
No, I think you're thinking of Robert Kraft and the Ivory Coast.
Oh, yes.
Yes, 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 yes.
Same initials. Robert Kraft, Rich Koch.
Yes.
That explains it. That explains
right.
It totally.
Yeah. Oh, totally, totally.
Totally.
Totally. Yes. Well, anyhow, what do you have in there?
I have a slush pile.
Oh. Yeah, I have one,
you
too.
You have one, too?
Yes.
Wow. So a good fairy must have come and given us a slush pile each.
Harold slumped into a chair like slush down a sewer, stunned.
Now, perhaps we should explain what this is exactly. This is
from the slush pile.
From the slush pile. Now, this comes from the National Lampoon's True Facts, and things like this have appeared in the True section since, I believe, September of 1977, with the following introduction. The following excerpts have been culled from unsolicited manuscripts sent to a prominent editor of serious fiction, who wishes, understandably, to remain anonymous. Now, what would you read your line one more time?
Harold slumped into a chair like slush down a sewer, stunned.
Interesting.
Curious.
I have a line here. Yeah, the archaeology professor said, I recently asked Mr. Bauman, the principal here at Harvard, for a raise.
Uh-huh. Mr. Bauman, huh?
principal at Harvard.
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
Yes, I'd rather pronounce that Bauman, actually.
Bauman, okay.
Not Bauman.
I like Bauman myself.
Yes.
But,
I followed her into the library, first with my eyes, then with my feet. It was well stacked with books.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
I'll say.
Through the door came a guy with big shoulders and a waist you could have slipped a donut around. He had a voice like a truck backfiring.
Oh, that's a good one. I know people whose breath smells like that, actually.
Like trucks backfiring?
Yeah.
I never really smelled a truck that was backfiring, but...
Well, I smelled my car backfiring.
Oh.
The small alarm clock exploded in the quiet stillness of the morning dawn.
That would be something if alarm clocks exploded.
Did you listen to Earplay this week?
I heard a couple of good plays on Earplay this week, yes.
Yeah, one of them was about an alarm clock, of all things. It didn't explode, though. Actually, it wasn't really about an alarm clock. It was about a guy waking up.
Yeah, it was about a guy waking up and the organs inside his body were
the first thing you heard...
British accents.
Yes, the exact first thing you heard was an alarm clock ring.
Uh-huh. And I imagine you heard it the way that the organs in his body heard it.
Yeah.
It must be kind of a hollow type of sound. That was an interesting play. And if you like Earplay and National Public Radio and all that, you can listen Thursday nights at 6.
Are we going to be repeating that one?
Maybe sometime. I really don't know.
Let's repeat it tonight.
I don't know if we can do that, but yeah. It's a possibility we can repeat that sometime.
Yeah.
We also have National Radio Theater beginning on Sunday at 6 with the Odyssey of Homer, so... Stay tuned for that. But now let's get back to our
slush pile. Why don't you read a few and I'll answer the phone.
Okay. Here's one. The church was as empty as the insides of a biopsy victim. Okay. Pardon? Let me try that again. Pardon, she asked, in a tone that made me want to wash my hands. Going to the washroom is one thing, I challenged her, and sneezing with your eyes closed is another. And, of course, I added sarcastically, death is the baby that makes three.
What's that supposed to
mean? I don't know. I'm glad someone else doesn't know, because I don't know what that means.
Here's an interesting...
Going to
what
the
sorry. Sorry. What the hell do you think you're doing, little junior? Little junior's father asked, his mouth smelling like a distillery out of the past.
Uh-huh. I'm glad I get to read this one.
Yes, I wish I could read that one.
She collapsed to the floor to the groaning sound of Ja! And that's spelled with three J's, four J's, and I believe about eight A's. And not even an exclamation point.
No, there's nine A's there.
9 days? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Okay.
Why can't we have a baby, Jenny demanded. Mass, Del, Mish, and Khan are the only states where independent adoptions are outlawed. Why would anybody say Mass, Del, Mish, or Khan? Why wouldn't they say Massachusetts, Delaware, Michigan, or Connecticut?
It's interesting. Why would anybody say that anyway? But,
insincerity always griveled, is that how you pronounce that word?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It looks like a strange word. Insincerity always griveled at her, especially when it surrogated the truth.
Whoa.
Mm, heavy.
He became lost in his scalp, thinking dark thoughts. It must be when somebody kind of like itches their head, you know? And
They're getting lost in there. After a day went by, Marilyn got restless because she had not heard from William. The telephone remained so still, it gathered dust on the dials.
That sounds like our phone in here. The blood crashing through my veins abruptly ceased its flow. All was now silent. I was dead.
Bob was easy to recognize underwater.
You put a good front on, he flattered me. But you don't fool anyone, let alone me.
Yeah. An ardent sex parasite. I often spent uncanny amounts of money at a time for absolutely enchanting evenings of sexual gusto.
Bobby Franklin's godmother, how would you pronounce that?
Maisie,
said that he always gave her the impression of having just stepped off an ironing board.
At first glance, she appeared fragile, but her shapely arms below the elbow belied this.
David Manchester was no homebody. He liked to spend his days standing at the finish line at the racetrack. Finish spelled with two N's, like where all the Finnish people come in.
Jane was bored silly with her job as secretary to the editor of a house organ at a paper cup factory.
Oh, this is too much. People actually write these things.
House organ, yes.
And you didn't even know what a house organ was.
But I do know what a paper cup factory is.
Oh, okay. The minister was short, with meticulously cut short hair, a frail physique, and a quiet rash above his collar.
She listened intently with all her ears.
All 22 of them. Aside from being nervous, Linda was not an extremely nice person.
A girl like Evelyn would stop at nothing to get her name in footlights.
Can you just imagine writing Evelyn on a piece of paper, throwing it in the footlights? The bookcase was made of solid walnuts and polished to a high shine.
To a high shine.
Made out of solid walnuts.
The nurse peeped into my bedpan and put it on the floor, whispering, shh.
It's just spelled S-H, S-H, two-letter word.
Like, as in, shh.
Yeah.
As what the contents of a bedpan generally are.
Let's continue.
Her large gray eyes were the window of an unhappy soul which dwelled deep inside her.
Tragic.
Hmm.
His eyes fell instantly on Trudy's black nightgown, which she was occupying.
A classic.
I think so.
The playboy slammed the wardrobe door shut and eyed the girl. I'd like to know where Kevin fits in all this, he demanded.
Excuse me. Getting to me.
Right about there. Oh, sorry. The man wore a charcoal gray three-piece suit and sported a diamond ring on his pinky that Sergeant Miller exaggerated to himself as being the size of a hamburger.
Bert didn't wake Lana when he got home, and when she woke in the morning, his side of the bed wasn't soiled.
Okay. Very interesting. Joni's thoughts fell silent.
And the sweater was coral and snug, emphasizing her torso's assets.
Well, folks, that's the slush pile for tonight. If there's anything that you'd like to hear again, and you'd like to share with your friends, by all means, you know, we'll have a countdown if necessary. 246-7901 is our telephone number, area code 516-WUSB. Right now, though, we're going to put these little slush pile things right out of their misery. Oh, there they go. Ah.
Yes, do we have the tripods ready?
The tripods are ready, and, would you like to go right into the tripods?
Sure, right after that, the news?
And right after that, the news. And right after that, our classic album side.
Oh.
So stay tuned to the voice of Long Island.
Radio Free Long Island, in solicitation with the Three Villains Tobacco Farms, proudly presents the exciting adventures of the Tripod family. The story of one of America's most illustrious families and their struggle to find peace and happiness in the suburbs of Long Island. When we left Kathy and Howard last week on their boat to France, the mysterious stranger threatened to wreck their marriage. Now as we look in on them, we hear...
All right, Kathy, let's just drop it. I know some pretty crazy things have been happening in the last few weeks. Let's just write off this mysterious stranger as another unexplained event.
Yes, yes. There's no point in letting this thing ruin our entire trip after all. Oh, we're supposed to be enjoying ourselves, aren't we?
That's right. You know, everybody back home is probably thinking about all the fun we should be having right now.
Mm.
Yeah, it's kind of funny when you
yeah,
think.
Yeah, isn't it? Oh, we just walk into another crazy situation.
That's right.
And they don't know anything about it.
That's right. Unless it was somebody back home who put someone up to all this.
Oh, no. Howard, you don't honestly think... Oh, it couldn't be.
I don't know, Kathy. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, I believe you when you say you never saw this person before. But still... He definitely knows who you are, and not only that, he must have found out who you were within the last 10 or so years since he called you Kathy Tripod.
Oh, yes, that sounds reasonable. But, how could you believe that anybody we know would pull a trick on us like that? I mean, nobody in either one of our families is a real mischief maker. I mean, none of our friends either, right?
Well, let's just think about...
Would our friend Charlie pull a trick like that on us? Now, ever since we moved to Long Island, he's gone out of his way to help us out. He's one of the very best neighbors that folks like us could ever have.
Right. Well, yeah, I know all of that. It's obvious that Charlie's not the one who's responsible.
Well, what about Pop? Oh, would your own father pull a silly prank on you, his only son? Hmm. Well, would he?
I don't know. Pop's always had a kind of bizarre sense of humor. And he does do some pretty silly things now and then.
Oh, come on.
Like the time he punched in some extra holes on our bill from the Big Bear City Electric Company.
Oh, yes, and he sent it in. And he fouled up their computer. It was a riot.
Oh. Kathy, there's nothing funny about a $22,000 electric bill. And I almost had to pay it, too.
Yeah, mortgage the house.
To this day, I think that computer has me marked down as a troublemaker.
Hmm. Oh, come on, Howard. You take things too seriously. We cleared that whole thing up months ago.
Right. With the people who work at the electric company, but not with the computer that runs it. And that's what scares me. Anyway, I doubt if Pop has anything to do with the stranger on this boat. That seems too sophisticated for him.
Well, we're running out of culprits. I don't think anybody on my side of the family would be up to this kind of skullduggery.
Oh.
There aren't that many of them that still keep in touch anyway. Only Uncle Jonathan and... Howard... Why are you smiling like that?
Uncle Jonathan. That's it.
What are you talking about?
He's behind all this. I know it. For some reason, Kathy, that man wants to wreck our marriage.
What? Howard, you talk as if you're losing your mind.
I know it seems crazy, Kathy, but look. Remember when he had me go down to Whitney Island to make that film? And he made you think I ran off with that French actress. I don't even remember her name again. What? Do you remember, Kathy?
Something about it.
Losing my train of thought.
Bridge.
Bridge over trouble. Brigitte.
La Roux. La Roux.
La Roux.
Brigitte. La
Roux. That almost split us up for good, Kathy.
Oh, it sure did.
Well, why are we laughing? It's because of him that we had to leave Big Bear City. And you know what a strain that put on us.
But what would Uncle Jonathan have to gain by breaking up the Tripod family?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Howard, look! Land! We've arrived in France, see?
What?
It's green, just like on the map.
So it is. My, we're coming in kind of fast, though, aren't we?
Yeah, we must be going about 45 miles an hour. Maybe the captain doesn't know we're here yet.
look at all those people. See them on the shore? They're waving and pointing over there in the harbor.
Oh, they better get out of the way before...
So Howard and Kathy arrive in France for the start of their vacation. But is Uncle Jonathan plotting to destroy the tripod marriage? You want to tune in next week when we'll hear Howard say,
"Hey, doesn't anybody here speak English?"
That's next week on The Tripod Family, a presentation of Radio Free Long Island and the Three Village Tobacco Farms. This is Don Topeka. For the news.
Yeah.
And today is Saturday, October 17th, the 290th day of 1981. There are 75 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history.
Huh? Oh, is it my turn?
Yes.
On October 17th, 1977, West German commandos stormed a hijacked Lufthansa airliner at an airport in Somalia and freed all 86 hostages aboard. On this date,
in 1854, British and French forces began the siege of Sevastopol in the Crimea, and in 1945, Colonel Juan Perón staged a coup in Buenos Aires and became the absolute ruler of Argentina.
In 1968, it was announced that former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy would marry Greek shipping tycoon Aristotle Onassis, and in 1978, Pope John Paul II, taking the reins of the Vatican, promised a ministry of love.
10 years ago, the Pittsburgh Pirates defeated the favored Baltimore Orioles 2-1 to win the 68th World Series in the seventh game.
And 5 years ago, the Peking garrison vowed allegiance to Prime Minister Hua Guofeng as chairman of the Central Committee of China's Communist Party.
1 year ago, late Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Ali Rajai, addressing the United Nations Security Council, gave no hope for release of the American hostages.
Mm-hmm. And today's birthdays? Former actress Rita Hayworth is 63, playwright Arthur Miller is 66, and Evel Knievel, that venerable stunt performer, is 43 degrees Celsius. Sorry, 43 years old.
Okay. Thought for today, there's always a comforting thought in time of trouble when it is not our trouble. And that was the thought. It came to you from Donald Robert Perry Marquis, one of those people who takes four names and some people don't even have one.
Uh-huh.
He was an American columnist, 1878 to 1937. And Ohio's U.S. Senator Howard Metzenbaum, a Democrat, and a wait a second. I shouldn't be reading this now, I don't think.
Oh.
Should I?
I don't know.
Why don't you read what you have?
What number do you have?
I think this is either 10 or 20.
I have 10 right here.
Oh, then I must have 20. I can't read your handwriting.
A federal agency is offering a reassuring pat on the back to Americans who've begun bracing for winter. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission says there shouldn't be any significant disruption of natural gas service or supplies, even if this winter is colder than normal. The Energy Department gave a similar prediction earlier in the week.
Top elected Democrats from around the country continue a meeting Saturday in Baltimore, a gathering aimed at getting back some of the ground their party lost in the 1980 elections. House Speaker Tip O'Neill told the group Friday there's no question in his mind that the U.S. is turning back to the Democrats. O'Neill says President Reagan's popularity is suffering because, in O'Neill's words, he has gone too far.
The president is moving closer to his goal of winning the support of 50 senators on the AWACS cell to Saudi Arabia. That's how many he needs to avoid a congressional veto of the deal. The latest Associated Press poll shows him just one short of that goal now that he's won Democrat Bennett Johnston of Louisiana over to his side.
The Social Security Administration says an average worker will pay about $100 more into the pension system next year than he did in 1981. The rate hike boosts average contributions to over $1,000. Congress ordered the higher rate back in 1977 to bail Social Security out of an earlier fiscal crisis.
Two states, Tennessee and Maryland, have decided to deny unemployment benefits to air traffic controllers fired by President Reagan in August. An appeals tribunal in Tennessee said the controllers had been warned what would happen if they walked out. And a Maryland hearing examiner says the controllers aren't eligible because they walked off the job illegally.
A Seattle medical examiner has issued a ruling in the case of a 16-year-old girl who died at a Rolling Stones concert at Seattle's King Dome on Thursday. The coroner said the teenager's death was an accident. The girl apparently fell off a ramp at the arena, becoming the first person to die inside the 5-year-old Dome Stadium.
It's probably the first one to die on a Rolling Stones tour this year, too.
I think so.
A city official says a stairway in the lobby of the Hyatt Regency Chicago Hotel has been closed for renovation because of tests showing that its reinforcing beams were inadequate. The tests were ordered after a suspended walkway at the Hyatt Hotel in Kansas City collapsed in July, killing 113 people.
Now, two Army officers have reached their final resting place 37 years after their deaths. Captain William Gronmeyer of Green Bay, Wisconsin, and First Lieutenant Charles Springer, Jr. of Rochester, Minnesota, were buried Friday at Fort Snelling National Cemetery in Minneapolis. The remains were found in the New Guinea jungle last year by a search party, years after their plane crashed on the way to a 1945 New Year's party.
Now, I think you have there something about LTV and Grumman?
Yes. New York's U.S. Senators Alphonse D'Amato and Daniel Patrick Moynihan and the two U.S. Senators from Ohio have called on the Senate Judiciary Committee to investigate the planned Grumman Corporation takeover by the Texas-based LTV Corporation. Grumman's aerospace plants employ 22,000 workers on Long Island, and the Grumman Company's flexible bus company subsidiary has plants at Loudonville in Delaware, Ohio. With Delaware's a city in Ohio. How about that?
Son of a gun.
3,000 more employees.
The four senators made the call in a letter to the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. In the letter, the four senators said that the internal company memoranda disclosed in court proceedings reveal that in order to obtain the huge loans necessary to finance this takeover, LTV plans to divest itself of the bus operation. In their letter, the senators say this can result in the loss of thousands of jobs in a state already afflicted with very high unemployment.
Ohio's U.S. Senator Howard Metzenbaum, a Democrat and a member of the committee, noted that hearings are scheduled to start October 27th on the general issue of the wave of mergers now going on in this country.
And Senator Metzenbaum asked for separate hearings on the proposed Grumman takeover to be held in Ohio and at Bethpage, where Grumman has its headquarters. That letter, which also was signed by Senators John Glenn of Ohio, a Democrat, and New York's Democrat Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and Republican Alphonse D'Amato, say the on-site hearings are being sought so we may learn from those directly involved with the full ramifications of those takeovers. D'Amato already has scheduled a hearing on the Grumman takeover in the Small Business subcommittee next week.
It really wasn't much of a small business, but...
No. as big as you get, actually.
Yeah.
This story involving Fisher's Island, the federal investigator says he's found no evidence of mechanical failure in a single-engine plane that crashed on Fisher's Island, critically injuring a newspaper photographer.
Yeah, Jack Sauer of Waterford, the 32-year-old chief photographer for the Day of New London, was shooting pictures of a house fire from the chartered Cessna aircraft when the plane went down in the Hay Harbor section of Fisher's Island about 10:45 Thursday morning.
Sauer, who suffered head and chest injuries, remains unconscious in the intensive care unit of New London's Lawrence and Memorial Hospital. Pilot Richard Slajewski, who was 57, and of the Gales Ferry section of Ledyard, was in satisfactory condition with scalp cuts and chest injuries, according to a hospital spokesman.
Yeah, well, the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board are investigating the cause of the crash. Witnesses said the plane came in low to view the house fire, struck a roof of another house, and crashed into trees about an eighth of a mile from the fire. Dennis Jones, air safety investigator with the Transportation Board, said Friday he found no evidence to substantiate earlier reports that attributed the crash to mechanical problems.
Jones says there was no evidence of mechanical problems, and I would add, he says, that witnesses at the scene did hear engine sounds after the plane hit the house. We found the left main gear adjacent to the house that was on fire. Jones said the plane had been returned to its owner, but the FAA impounded Sauer's equipment and film, hoping it might provide more information. The plane was owned by Coastal Air Services Incorporated and was flown out of Groton, New London Airport, according to officials.
You have a look at the weather there?
Yes, I do. In fact, it's 11 degrees right now in Stony Brook, 52 Fahrenheit. Should be getting down into the 40s tonight. Sunny, cool tomorrow. Highs will be all the way up into the 60s. Expecting increasing cloudiness tomorrow night. Chance of a couple of showers developing at night. Lows tomorrow night in the 40s. And the outlook for Sunday, chance of some showers with the highs in the 60s.
Huh.
For all you folks out on boats, though, small craft advisory is in effect for north to northwest winds, 15 to 25 knots, and gusty tonight.
Hmm.
Some of that autumn weather I was telling you about. Well, it might be a little foggy, too. You there, Mike? Well, now he's not talking. All right, eight minutes. That's making silly sounds. 8 minutes after 2 o'clock.
You're tuned to WUSB
in Stony Brook,
New York.
And, Mike, do you have any major plans for the next week? I'm just curious.
I'm not too sure.
Traveling anywhere or doing anything of interest?
Let's see. No.
Look on your calendar.
I don't think so, not offhand.
Oh, you told me you were working tomorrow. That's a shame.
Yeah.
Because, Environmental Action here at Stony Brook is sponsoring a walk into, actually a march into Port Jefferson.
Oh, yeah? How many people are going to be attending?
Well, hopefully as many as we can get, at least a couple of dozen.
Oh.
And what we're going to do is, in support of a statewide bottle bill, as you know, Suffolk County has a bottle bill that will be in effect, I believe, next April,
mm-hmm.
thanks to Mr. Peter Cohallen. We are marching in support of a statewide bottle bill, and what we're going to do is gather bottles and cans that have been thrown on the side of the road by all the drunkards who are out right now. We're going to pick them up and march into Port Jefferson, throw them all into the van, and pull up in front of the Village Hall in Port Jefferson. Should be at around 2 o'clock or so. And this is to demonstrate how badly a bottle bill is needed, both here and everywhere.
So what are you going to do with the bottles?
Well, we'll have them recycled.
Oh.
We always do that. But I'd just like to invite anybody who's interested in doing something like this. It starts tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Now, it's kind of short notice, but if you get some sleep now, you can get up in time.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm going to be there some way. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'll do it. The folks are going to meet in the Student Union Building here at the campus of Stony Brook at 10 o'clock in the morning, room 079.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Enact office. It's down the hall from the pinball machines and right across from the post office, so you shouldn't have much trouble. The automatic post office, which everybody hates.
We'll be leaving at 10 o'clock in the morning, room 079.
I'm sure you could join them along 25A anywhere, right?
Sure. We won't be going necessarily just along 25A. We'll be going all sorts of roads. But if you see a big white van that says Enact Recycling on it, that's us.
Gosh, you may even go past my house.
Yeah, that's where we'll get most of the bottles from.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, you led yourself into that one.
Yeah,
but,
I guess I did, didn't I?
Repeating that once again, 246, the phone number for Enact is 246-7088 if you have any questions on this. I don't think anybody's down there now, but...
But you'd be able to answer them at 246-7901.
You can call me up, and I'll gladly answer them for you. Once again, 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, we'll be marching into Port Jefferson with bottles and cans.
Yeah.
Demonstrate our support for a clean environment. Something positive to think about.
Yeah.
Something else positive to think about, Mike, is our album side.
Yes, and why did you pick it this week?
Well, I picked this album side
because it was clogged.
Sorry. Because it was what?
Clogged.
I don't understand.
Well, if it was your nose, you would.
Uh-huh. Well, the band's name is Sky. Does that have anything to do with it, Mike?
No. I asked, why did you pick it?
Oh. How about if I just turn you off?
No.
No!
Yeah, I'll keep them low anyway.
Help! Can anybody hear me?
Sky consists of,
help!
Five people. Five very talented musicians.
Help!
John Williams.
Help!
Oh, it's nice to have power. Herbie Flowers. Kevin Peek. Tristan Fry. Francis Monkman, and I got to say, that's five people right there. Now, according to Cashbox Magazine, Sky is no ordinary new band. Their destiny as one of the 1980s greats seems already set. They do a rendition here that's very popular among among Stony Brook students and among regular people, too. A version of Toccata's Fugue, kind of a rockish version, but very nice. And this is a double album of theirs. Their debut album. I believe they have one more that's out right now. On Arista Records, we're going to hear side three. And there are six compositions on this side, and they vary all sorts of different music. Maybe we can discuss it afterwards, but it's kind of hard to discuss it until you hear it. Tuba Smarties sort of gives itself away. It's a very nice tuba tune, which we'll be hearing. In just a moment, Ballet Volta will follow that, Gavant and Variations, followed by Andante, Tristan's Magic Garden, and El Cielo. I think I pronounced that right, El Cielo. Okay, if anybody has anything to add to that, if you know something about these compositions themselves, I'm not all that familiar with them. Give us a call once again, 246-7901. Also, if you'd like to suggest any interesting album sides for future dates, we're going to start off with Tuba Smarties now. It was recorded live at the Dominion Theater. That's in London. And the album came out in 1980. So without any further ado, Sky on USB.
The
Yes, we just heard from side three
of an album called Sky. And you hear it clicking. I was listening to a classical station the other night. They were playing some stuff. Apparently they were tracking through an album side just like this. Well, not the album wasn't just like this, but they did it just like this. And directly after the album, they went into the news or something. And the guy was talking. And this whole time you heard the needle skipping at the last groove. The last revolution it made. Well, we don't do that here, of course. But it wasn't the kind of thing I would have expected to hear on a classical station. This is definitely a very interesting album from Sky. Includes all sorts of neat things. We heard side three. The songs we heard were Tuba Smarties, Ballet Volta, Gavotte and Variations, Andante, Tristan's Magic Garden, and El Cielo. A wide variety of stuff, even on that one side. Let's see, Eric's not here right at this moment, so I'm going to be doing all the talking myself, at least until he gets back with the food. He should be in his car. He wanted me to say hello. Hi, Eric. Let's see now. Let's just mention the members of this band. John Williams. And there's all fairly extensive biographies on each of these fellows. But it says here, film soundtracks in which John played include The Deer Hunter and Stevie, though not Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, etc., for which John's namesake should be held responsible. And all this time you thought it was this John Williams, huh? Also Herbie Flowers, Kevin Peake, Tristan Fry, and Francis Monkman. All here on this Sky album. All sorts of neat things. You know, I just want to, like, see if I can't get this out right. And I'll pull it out of the sleeve here and just play you a few notes from one of the songs called Hada. That's the kind of music I'm really kind of into. It sounds like it would be good under a commercial or something like that. Like you see the designer jeans running, crossing the finish line, finish with two N's. So that's Sky. Normally I wouldn't do this, but this particular song is one of my favorites on the album, so I just had to throw it on for at least a few seconds. Anyway, you tune to USB, 2:40 in the morning, 10 degrees outdoors. That's 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Mike Juhas here, Eric Corley somewhere else. And it's been a while. Let's just get rid of these for now. It's been a while since we've heard from Bunky and Spunky.
Gives you.
There's more than one technique for this. You can say and do a few things real slow, or you can just throw a ton of stuff together so fast that no one can tell it stinks anyway.
Be careful what you say on camera, gang. The FCC can take away your license if you use words like or especially.
One last tip. Don't bother to to have rehearsal. Because if the actors know their lines, the show will go much too fast, and that just means more work for the writer.
So this is Spunky.
And Spunky saying, even you can be a TV star. And
don't play with blasting caps.
Yeah.
Well, right now, I think I'm going to get into some of the latest Residents album. Ooh, right here on USB.
You know, Rob Zeiser is going to be in about 15 minutes. What do you say that we just take some of his time?
That is the dumbest idea I think I've ever heard.
Okay, so yeah, I guess then we should just keep playing the record.
Everybody thinks Eric's in the studio.
Absolutely not.
Yes, he is.
Turn that off. Turn that off, please. Oh, boy. Mike, I'm glad I'm the one who went out tonight to get stuff. You know, let me tell you something. The Voice of Long Island is one of the few programs on the air in which you can participate and take a drive across town at the same time. It's really great. And it's also the first time I ever heard Bunky and Spunky on my car radio.
Wow.
I thought that was great.
Yeah.
It's a whole new experience whatsoever.
So you got... No.
Really? No, I rephrase
it. Yeah, please do. Well, no, don't even bother to rephrase
it. It's not
crazy.
Worth it. And please turn me off. No, I don't mean me. I mean the tape of me that you're playing.
What little tape of me?
Play it one more time, please.
I can't.
Why not?
It's not queued up yet.
It should be any second. I'm not so sure.
Yeah,
that's it. Don't play that anymore, Mike.
Okay.
Let me tell you some of the crazy things going on out there, Mike.
Tell me.
Well, let me tell you the most immediate, first of all. As I pulled into the entrance here on campus, I happened to just take a look into my rearview mirror, and I saw a car that had apparently just moments ago flipped over totally. It literally flipped over. And I knew it had happened recently because the light was still on in the car and there were people standing around. So, of course, I backed up right away and just asked if they were having any problems.
Of course we're having problems.
Well, they were having problems, but luckily nobody was hurt. I gave somebody a ride. That was why I was kind of late. I gave someone a ride over to a room. And they got some help for the car. But really, folks, be careful out there. It's no point in killing yourself just to get somewhere a little faster. This car just rounded a curve, and over it was. And these people weren't hurt. They weren't wearing seatbelts or anything. I don't know how they did it.
That's probably why they weren't hurt.
No, you bounce around in a car. It was kind of a big car. You can get pretty hurt. Little objects can become missiles of
horrible
force. I do. Some other things. I was driving along, and... suddenly, I was in this newspaper storm. You ever been in a newspaper storm? I'm serious. Someone dropped a ton of newspapers in the middle of the street.
A ton of newspapers.
It seemed that way, and I was going, you know, along on a road, minding my own business, and then suddenly, boom.
It's more stuff for you and the rest of the Enact people to pick up tomorrow.
We'll pick it up. Well, one newspaper. Would you turn that off?
Not really.
Mike, turn that off.
Oh, no. Okay, one more.
No, I really don't think so. Are you quite finished?
Yes.
Thank you. So, that's what's going on out there.
Take all my fun out of the show.
Yeah. Lots of news. I spotted a USB bumper sticker, too.
Really?
Yeah. It was going by kind of fast. If that person's out there, don't you go too fast. You'll flip over, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Earlier this evening, we didn't get pizza tonight, but I had some earlier tonight, and I was at this place. Apparently, Friday night is pizza night in this world. And this place I went to was unbelievably busy. There were 15 people behind the counter.
You said 14 before.
Well, maybe I was wrong. 14, 15, something like that. They were all moving, though, at this incredibly fast speed, at like 78 RPM, when they're supposed to be going at 33 and a third, you know? And it was just so funny watching them. So when I got in there, I couldn't stop smiling. And, of course, that didn't help in getting myself served, you know, because they saw that I was smiling and they weren't having a very good time, you know, shuffling around like that. So after standing around for about 10 minutes trying to get through the crowd and everything, I realized I wasn't getting anywhere, so I had to actually go outside to a payphone that was right outside the place and call them up. To call in my order. And even then, it took four tries before I got through. Oh, boy. And then 45-minute wait. But it was worth it.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of people there. Hundreds of people, literally, banging at the doors.
And a good pie, too, huh?
Yeah. It was.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening outside. Inside, not as much, but it's good to be back.
That's good.
It's not so cold out. It feels like about 11 degrees.
No, it's 10 now.
Is it 10?
Yeah. That's 50F.
Oh. Nice night for driving.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the stars and feel the wind. And I believe the moon's out, too. I didn't really get a chance to look up there.
Is there any fog out there?
No. None at all.
No.
Nope.
No.
No, Mike. There's none of it.
All right. So what do you say we eat our food and get into some polecats?
We only have 6 minutes left, Mike.
So what? Let's play a tune.
Should we say goodbye now? Or
no, we'll be back.
Watch out for that machine gun over right.
Oh,
that one.
Okay.
Yeah, the Polecats
on USB.
I got my mouth full. How about you?
No, but I got my hands full.
Oh, you must be queuing up our record. Rob tells me I'm right.
Well, Mike, another show has gone by.
Yeah.
And in it, we've done several things.
It was very interesting talking to the fellow up in Dartmouth.
I think we got more of a grasp as to what that paper's all about, what that what his philosophy is. And, of course, we welcome any feedback on that. In the future, we'll be talking to all sorts of other interesting people.
You may be next.
You never know. We may get you.
Eventually, we will.
You don't have to worry now. You don't have to worry tomorrow, but come next Friday, you just might be on the air.
Yeah.
In front of, who knows? You never know who's listening.
That's true.
Never.
We never do. We usually think nobody's listening.
You usually think nobody's listening.
Well,
but I know there are people out there. People driving in their cars, people flying in their planes, people sailing on their boats, people walking in the street, people sitting in their houses, people lying in bed, and all sorts of other things, too.
Go on. People swimming in their pools?
Yeah, that, too.
Mm-hmm.
People sitting in their backyard.
Yeah, mm-hmm, sure.
In their cellars.
In 10 degrees Celsius weather, huh?
Cleaning out the chimney.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, cleaning out the chimney.
Yeah, the moths are out at that time. They don't get in your eyes too much.
They're not out in the daytime this time of year either.
Well, that's true, but let's not argue about chimney sweeping.
Yeah.
But there are people out there, all over the place. Some as far away as Philadelphia, I understand. Sometimes.
Some as far away as Setauket.
Setauket?
Yes. Some as far away as Bayshore, in fact. While you were gone, I had a gentleman call up from Bayshore.
Is that so?
Yeah.
And what's going on in that hip town?
I don't know.
Well, I was down there a few times in the near past.
In the near past, huh?
Yeah.
Well, listen, we are going into Rob Zeiser's time.
We are, aren't we? And isn't it something? Rob always lets us get away with
it. It's
this.
A tradition, though, isn't it?
It is.
Well, he's going to be here for the next 9 hours or so until Eric Price shows up.
9 hours?
Well, 8 hours.
8 hours?
6 hours.
No.
5 hours.
5 hours.
Hey.
That's better. 5 hours. Okay, that's quite a shift coming up.
Yeah, Eric Price will be in around, around 8 o'clock.
Around 8 o'clock.
And then Tahira.
With some Pakistani music.
At 11.
Coming up at noon,
Lister
with some reggae. He'll be taking you until
3:30
when Felix comes in with his
Latin and Salsa
show
called
Onda Nueva,
which
that goes
until about 6 o'clock.
At which time,
Emission Cousin
right after Stardate, and that goes until 7. And at 7 o'clock we hear
classical music until
10 o'clock.
At 10 o'clock we hear
Jazz Live,
which... From National
Public
Radio.
And Jazz Live is funded by an underwriting grant?
By the undergraduate student... No, graduate
oh,
student...
No, no, graduate student organization. There is no undergraduate student organization.
There should be.
I don't know. So it takes
how
the fun
they...
out of being an undergraduate when there's student organization.
Well, how come there's an underwriting grant from a graduate student organization?
Are you saying it should be an overwriting grant?
Mm-hmm.
You're being silly again,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's I'm sure we'll go into that in the future.
Oh
no.
Yes. Yes.
See now, even you're talking.
Well, there's a temptation. This thing sitting right here with all my negative remarks on it.
Come on, we can do better than that.
That's
how
probably
true.
True.
That's probably
oh,
true.
How true.
Yeah, I think that. No. On second thought, no.
All right.
Definitely not.
I'm getting mixed up now. I don't know which is the real you.
Yeah, you know what it's like now. I didn't know which was the real me before. Well, okay, we will be back next week at 12:02 a.m., kicking off the old Radio Free Weekend.
On WUSB
Stony Brook, New York. Right now, it's Saturday night. Well, actually, it's Saturday morning, Friday night. What have you?
Yeah.
Well, you folks driving home, be careful, please. I don't want any more flip-overs to see, huh?
I'll be back Thursday night at 9.
I'll be back Tuesday night at 9.
Mike Juhas here.
Eric Corley there.
It's been a real pleasure and a privilege. Goodbye.
Same here.
Dates and friends. That's what I do at weekends. I can't talk and I can't walk. But I know where I'm going to go. I'm going to watch my money go. At the Locarno, no. When my feet go through the door, I know what my right arm is for. Buy a drink and call a chair. Up to the edge of the dance floor. Dancers bouncing through the night. Trying to stop or start a fight. I sit and watch the flashing lights. Moving legs in footless tights. I go out on Friday night and I come home on Saturday morning. I go out on Friday night and I come home on Saturday morning. I like to venture into town. I like to get down. The floor gets packed, the bar gets full. I don't like life when things get dull. The hen party have saved the night. Free themselves from drunken stacks. Having fun, dancing in a circle round the leather bags. I go out on Friday night and I come home on Saturday.
I'm Rob Zeiser,
And I'm Rob Zeiser, too. Rob Zeiser's clones here.
Yes.
On USB FM.
Where else?
Taking it until 8 o'clock with all sorts of good stuff.
The station that never stops.
It may sound like we're the same people who were just around before, but no, that's not in fact true. That is, in fact, a strange noise here.
Yes, very strange noises and loud sorts of feedback, and it sounds like we're in a tunnel.
We've taken control here. Rob Zeiser will, maybe he'll be... Rob, put that down!
Well,
Rob!
We can get into some...
Hey, put it down.
Oh! Yes, we can get into some Rob Zeiser music, though, maybe.
We certainly can.
Oh, come on. Let's not overdo it now, huh?